you might be a little triggered by what we talk about, just because it's going to be real, and it might remind you of some things in your past, and if you just need to take a break, that's okay. It's okay for you to get up and take care of yourself and go to the bathroom or go outside and get a breath of fresh air, whatever you need to do, because we're going to really talk about some ugly realities that happen, and we're going to talk about it truthfully, because it's really important that we face things truthfully. God calls us to walk in the truth and to live in the truth, and that includes facing the darkness that might even be in the walls of our church. So we're going to talk about that, and if that upsets you or triggers you, please take care of yourself. Second of all, I want to hear from you what are the key takeaways that you came here thinking, okay, I hope she covers this, or I'll be really disappointed if I leave and she didn't talk about that. So if some of you could, especially if you really have one of those, if you would share with me so that I can be sure to tailor things or let you know up front that that's not going to be covered, and then you can decide what you're going to do. Anybody have any like burning, I need to know this before I leave? Yes. Okay, so why is the pattern repeated? We'll touch on that. We're not going to talk as much about, we'll talk a little bit about the emergency therapeutic needs of the victim and the safety and sanity concerns. Those are longer term therapy needs, which I'll touch on, but I'm glad you brought that up because it's a really important topic. Yeah. We're going to talk about that because I think that's really important that we understand it's not just the pastors who may do that, it's the counselors who do that. I taught a couple of weeks ago at Liberty, well, it wasn't at Liberty University, it was at Liberty University, but it wasn't sponsored by Liberty University, but the graduate professor of marriage and family counseling at Liberty University who teaches the curriculum there came up to me after I spoke and he said, we offer nothing on this stuff in the graduate program of marriage and family counseling. And so it's not just pastors who are inadvertently duped by what's going on, but counselors are too. And we'll talk about that and how that happens.
Well, I don't know if we're going to get this far, but guidelines for reconciliation.
Guidelines for reconciliation, we will talk about that. Okay, we will talk about what that looks like, what the roadmap to healing looks like. And actually tomorrow when I speak to the couples, I'm going to be talking about that in different language, and I'll talk about it with you, but really helping couples to see that the traditional things that we've done to try to put a marriage together, because that is our goal, if possible. Our goal is reconciliation, if possible, isn't it? But we want to do it in a healing way and not a duct tape kind of way. We don't want to be like the prophets of Israel who said they promised their people peace, peace when there is no peace. And so we want to understand what it takes if it's going to be put together, what the work is involved. Yeah.
What if they're
we'll talk about that. Okay, so we need to be understanding and we need to help, especially the victim, understand that somebody might be willing but not capable. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I think there's a difference between mental illness and character disorder. And I think sometimes we lump them in the same. So, for example, you might have a bipolar person who spends too much money or is reckless with their sexual integrity, things like that, and yet they're humbled by the consequence and they seek help and they accept help and they stay with the treatment program. Right? That's a very different person than a bipolar person who's too proud to do that and refuses help and refuses accountability, and they have a spouse that has to sort of pick up the pieces of this. Right? And so we want to differentiate between someone who's got some mental illness and is willing to take responsibility for it and get help for it, and someone who's got some mental illness, whether it's or physical illness. Right? There might be physical illness that causes someone to be destructive as well. And they're not taking responsibility for that physical illness either. Yeah, the church is really good at emergencies, but they're not good at chronic problems, right? So I think that's been my experience, is that if there's an emergency, woof, you know, we'll come in and help you. But if there's something ongoing, chronic, like mental illness, like destructive marriages, where it requires ongoing care and support, they're not so good at that. And so that's something that we really need to look at as a church and improve upon. Anything else that you just need to know before we... Okay. Okay, we will talk about that. Yep, somebody back here. Mm-hmm. Okay. Okay. Okay, so well, how do we talk to the abuser? How do we talk to the aggressor? That's going to be important. We're going to talk about that. Mm-hmm. And let me just say as a caveat at the beginning, I understand that women can be the aggressors. But we're not going to talk in that language today just because of time. I'm going to assume that the woman is more the victim and the man is the more the aggressor. But there is some differences. For example, even when the woman is the aggressor, rarely do men feel afraid of her. They may feel humiliated by her, for sure, but rarely do they feel afraid. Whereas a woman, when the man is aggressor, she does feel afraid. So there is a difference there. And there's also a power differential. When we talk about power and control, a woman, especially a Christian woman, especially a Christian woman in the church, has no biblical way she can justify power over her husband. Whereas a Christian man can, with an unaware pastor, unaware congregation, come in and justify power over his wife in the name of headship. And so there are some differentials that is important to distinguish when we talk about women being the aggressors, but we're not going to have the time to really go into all of that. So understand, it's not that I'm not aware that women are abusive. I grew up in a home where my mother was abusive and my father was the hero. So I love men who are good men and do good things and rescue, whether they're pastors or counselors or fathers, children out of situations. And we need more good men who speak up about this issue. But we're going to talk about it as you're probably going to see most of it. Right, anything else that is really important for you to get out of this time today before we get started? All right, so we're going to cover two main areas. The first one is the diagnostic piece, because if you can't see what's going on, if you can't really see what's happening in the session as a counselor, or if you can't really see what's happening in your congregation or with a woman who's coming to talk to you, then you won't be able to help her. And so we're going to cover the diagnostic piece. How do we differentiate different kinds of marriage problems? And how do we know when someone's really being abused, or are they just saying they're being abused, right? And so we want to talk about that, and how do we diagnose the problem? And then secondly, we're going to go into the treatment, all right? So now you see it's happening, but what do you do with it? What are the treatment strategies for both the man, the woman, and the couple, right? I'm not going to be able to go into big detail on all of those, but I will give you the outlines and some nuggets of real helpful tools that you can use with that. So, sound good? All right. Two years ago, Lifeway Research did a survey of among 1,000 Protestant pastors on their awareness of abusive issues in their congregation. And 74% of these pastors, you can Google the research on the internet, 74% of these pastors grossly underestimated the amount of abuse that was going on in their churches. But even more alarming, those pastors who said they were aware of the abuse in their congregations and they did have a protocol to dealing with it often caused more harm to the couples that had come to them or the individuals who had come to them for help. So it's very important that we understand that most of us do not handle this problem well. And I'm hoping that today, in our time together, you can just open yourself up. You don't get defensive or shamed by, oh my gosh, I made terrible mistakes. I have made all the mistakes we're going to talk about. I've been doing this for 30 years. I've made all of them and more, right? But I've learned a lot, and I know what works, and I know what doesn't work. And so I really want you to open yourself up and not get caught up in, oh my gosh, I missed something, or I hurt someone. but that you are here for a reason, and that is to begin to understand how to look at this situation differently. Now, Peter alluded to my own childhood, and so just let me tell you a little bit about it as I start. I grew up in a home. My mom and dad were married young, and my mom, by the time I was 8 years old, decided she didn't want to be married to my father anymore. Now, this was a long time ago, over 50 years ago, and so that was not heard of in those days. And my mom left my dad. She had some mental illness. I didn't know that at 8 years old. She had been hospitalized, but I really didn't know that either. I just, you know, you don't pay attention to those things when you're a kid. You're just a kid. But when she left my father, she drank, she was bipolar, she wasn't the depressed bipolar, she was a manic bipolar part, so she acted very scary and very unstable a lot of the time. She was often abusive, especially to me, probably because I was the one who challenged her the most and had the biggest mouth, and so she took it out on me. And so by the time I was 14 years old, my father, who had recommitted his life to Christ and became remarried and was really walking with the Lord, had been going to court to get custody of us for years and years and years. And I'll just shorten the story. So he got custody of us, and I went to live with my dad. But then my mom kind of disappeared out of our life. She was very rarely in our life, and when she was, it was really bad. She didn't come to our weddings. She didn't see our children. I had two siblings. She didn't see our children being born. So it wasn't a good relationship with mom, even as I began to be an adult, even as I became a Christian, even as I was a Christian counselor. I couldn't figure out how to get along with my mother. I knew you were supposed to honor your mother, but how to talk to her in a conversation that didn't resort in verbal vomit on me and some of my own verbal vomit back, I didn't know how to do that really well. And so that sort of started my journey. But then we fast forward. So I didn't have anything to do with my mom for 15 years in my adult life. Her choice mostly, but also I was relieved. And get this phone call. I didn't get it. My sister Pat got this phone call one day from her. Now I hadn't seen her in 15 years. And my mother is gasping on the end of the phone. My sister lives in Chicago. I lived in Pennsylvania. My mother lived in Florida. Can't hardly breathe. She says, I can't breathe. My sister says, Mom, what do you want me to do? You sound really sick. I think you need to call 911. So she did. And my sister called me, and she said, I think we need to go visit our mother. So this was really scary. And we went to go visit my mother. And it was really interesting because I hadn't seen her in 15 years. And I looked at the bed, and I thought, oh, my gosh, she looks just like me. Or I look just like her. It was pretty scary to look at somebody who looked like you. But the history of her illness was that she had gone to the doctor for months, and we had seen this in her journal. She'd gone, and she was diagnosed with bronchitis, and the doctor gave her antibiotic, and she was kept getting sicker and sicker, and she went back to the doctor, and he gave her more antibiotic, and he said, you have an asthma, you know, in situational asthma. He gave her asthma medicine. She was getting sicker and sicker until she made this phone call to my sister. And it turned out when we went down to the hospital, she was in intensive care and she never did have bronchitis. What she had was lung cancer. Now, I think the doctor meant well when he diagnosed her with bronchitis, but he didn't do enough investigation to find out what was really wrong, especially when she wasn't getting better. You see, antibiotics is a great medicine for bronchitis, but it's absolutely impotent with lung cancer. And sadly, a lot of counselors apply the biblical antibiotic for the bronchitis of the marriage. And when the patient is not getting better, the marriage is getting sicker and sicker and sicker. We tend to blame the patient instead of reevaluating our diagnosis. Instead of saying, maybe I haven't paid attention to what's wrong. Maybe this isn't bronchitis of the marriage. Maybe this isn't ordinary marriage problems. Maybe this isn't two sinners mutually sinning against each other. Maybe this is something far more serious. And you see, the confusing thing is that bronchitis and lung cancer share some of the same symptoms, don't they? Nagging cough, chronic fatigue, you know, this, you know, not feeling well. And so it can be easy for counselors to kind of look at a marriage situation and think they know what's going on. But they have not asked the right questions, nor have they even looked for the right situation to know what questions to ask. So we're going to watch a video now, and I just want to talk about this as we watch this video. So if you could turn the first video on, and we're just going to talk about this after you watch it.
Count how many times the players wearing white pass the ball. The correct answer is 16 passes. Did you spot the gorilla? For people who haven't seen or heard about a video like this before, about half missed the gorilla. If you knew about the gorilla, you probably saw it. But did you notice the curtain changing color or the player on the black team leaving the game? Let's rewind and watch it again. Here comes the gorilla, and there goes a player, and the curtain is changing from red to gold. When you're looking for a gorilla, you often miss other unexpected events. And that's the monkey business illusion.
All right, who wants to confess? How many did not see that big old gorilla in the middle of the room? Okay? That's what happens in counseling. We're so busy thinking that we're seeing what we're seeing that we're not seeing the gorilla. Or we're not seeing the curtain changing. Or we're not seeing the player exiting the room. Why was it that 74% of evangelical pastors didn't see what was going on right beneath their nose? Daniel Goleman writes this. He says, the range of what we think and do is limited by what we fail to notice. And because we fail to notice that we fail to notice, there's little we can do to change until we notice how our failing to notice shapes our thoughts and deeds. So I would begin this conversation with you by challenging all of us that we have failed to notice abuse in our congregations. We fail to notice abuse in the couple sitting before us for counseling. We fail to notice what's really going on, and because we fail to notice, just like my mother's doctor failed to notice, we prescribe a biblical solution to their problem that is impotent to fix those in destructive marriages. And then we wonder why they leave our church, or why their marriage breaks down, or why we read in the newspaper about someone getting killed. Because we didn't pay attention to what we needed to pay attention to. Now, I'm going to give you another example of a story that we have failed to notice the real story behind the story for years and years and years and years. And some of you may be absolutely horrified about what I'm going to say, but I'm going to say it anyway, and I want you to challenge you and go back and read your Bible a different way. So if David and Bathsheba, post all of what happened, came to see you for counseling, and they're sitting before you, unhappy, especially Bathsheba, miserable. Based on what you know, you would have to make a diagnosis of their problem. What's wrong? And based on your mindset of what happened and what's wrong, you would develop a treatment plan, right? Whether you're a lay counselor or whether you're a professional counselor, whether you're a pastor or you're just a friend, we're all making judgments about what's wrong. And so we might say, wow, David and Bathsheba are just plagued with guilt over what they did. They're just plagued with the guilt of having this affair and then, you know, murdering her husband, and they must be just in a bad spot. Maybe that's where you're thinking that I'd go. I'd be dealing with grief and guilt and all of that. Maybe they're still grieving over the lost child. Maybe they're still acting out in their sexual addictions, as we've diagnosed David as a voyeurist and Bathsheba as an exhibitionist. But if you were thinking those things, you would all be wrong. That's not their problem. And so to do a treatment plan based on those things would be missing the mark. And you wouldn't be helping David and Bathsheba. You see, the story as it's been told traditionally in the church has not been the correct story. David and Bathsheba did not have an affair. David abused Bathsheba. He raped her. The Bible says that. It says he saw her, he summoned her, he took her. Those are all aggressive words. How do you say no to the king? You don't. And then afterwards, here's the story, as I read it in the Bible. Bathsheba and David never talked again. He didn't have this affair with her. They didn't have a relationship. She was discarded. And then she sends him a note. How many months later? About 3 months later. Says, I'm pregnant. David didn't summon Bathsheba back to him and say, Bathsheba, my love, what are we going to do? He didn't talk to Bathsheba at all about it. He hatched a plan. Oh, how am I going to get rid of this? I made a terrible mistake. I raped her. I shouldn't have done that. I was the king. Whatever he thought, I'll just bring Uriah back and he can sleep with her and problem solved. They didn't have a love affair. You see this in callous indifference to Bathsheba? So he brings her husband back. Bathsheba's loyal to David. He doesn't go into his wife. Now David's got a bigger problem. Now what do I do? He still doesn't talk to Bathsheba about it. He decides to solve the problem another way by putting Bathsheba's husband Uriah in the front lines to have him killed. It says in the Bible very clearly, Bathsheba grieved over her husband. And when Nathan the prophet confronted David, here we hear the truth. Nathan didn't say, David, shame on you. What's going on with you that you and Bathsheba had this affair? Shame on you, Bathsheba. You shouldn't have done that. He didn't say that. Bathsheba wasn't part of that confrontation at all because Bathsheba was a victim. David was told by Nathan, you what? Took something that wasn't yours. You took something that was helpless and powerless to stop you. David, you abused your power as the king. And you took not only Bathsheba, you took her husband from her. You are guilty of abuse of power, David. And in the New Testament, the Holy Spirit continues to vindicate Bathsheba. When you read the genealogy of Christ in Matthew, it says Solomon, who's their child, son of David, son of Bathsheba, either wife or widow of Uriah. Never mentions her as the wife of David, even though David was the father of Solomon. So how come we got it so wrong? How is it that we've been talking about this relation? Every time I hear it, I'm just galled by it. Because that's not what the scripture teaches. And yet we fail to notice what we fail to notice because we don't want to see something ugly about David. It's bad enough that he killed her husband, but we think he did it out of this mutual love affair. He didn't. He didn't. And so we don't like to see someone that we like in an ugly light. And this often happens in counseling when a wife says, my husband, you know the husband, you're the pastor. It's not like you're a counselor, you never met these people. You're the pastor, you know this guy. He's a great guy, he's given lots of money to the church, he's a deacon on your board, and he's the Sunday school superintendent, and I can't believe that he'd be capable of this. No, I can't see it, I won't see it. And therefore we don't see it. But just like there were really wonderful things about David, there were some really awful things about David too. And a lot of them were hidden from most people. In the same way, we can be really fooled. The Bible tells us that there are very charming people who are very deceptive. And they are in our churches. They're called wolves in sheep's clothing. And they are very good at lying. And they are very good at charming. And they are very destructive at home. But they're very concerned about their image. And so they will do everything they can to look good. So, how do we discern the difference between a difficult marriage, a destructive marriage, and a disappointing marriage? Because they share a lot of the same symptoms, don't they? And some of the symptoms are at least one, or if not two, of the people in the marriage are unhappy. So how do we discern the difference? And I'm not going to go into a lot of differences, but let me just give you a few. A difficult marriage is where there's a lot of external stressors. Autistic children, second marriages, blended families, economic problems, a lot of moves, military, in-law problems, financial worries, health issues. There's a lot of stuff going on. And it's difficult. But if this couple can handle difficulty with maturity and resiliency and support, difficult isn't destructive. It's just difficult. A disappointing marriage is often where, and most of the time it's the woman who's disappointed, because she thought she was getting one guy and she married another, right? And oftentimes she thought he was going to be more ambitious or more romantic or more intellectual or more fun. I remember talking to a woman who was raised in a very tumultuous home. And her father was adulterer, lots of different things. And her mother was just unstable. And she met this guy in college, and he was like this steady Eddie. And he was so steady and so calm, and she just felt so safe with him. And so she married him. But about 10 years later, she was so bored. Like, he was as steady as could be. Nothing sinful, nothing, like, he wasn't cheating or he wasn't hurting her, he wasn't doing anything financially that was sneaky. He was just kind of a boring guy. You know, he didn't like to do adventurous things. He was just steady Eddie. And for a while, that felt really good to her. But after a few years, she got pretty disappointed. Like, I want more from him. I want more from our marriage. I want more from this. So that's a disappointing marriage, all right? And depending on how she handles that, if she starts attacking him and being critical and demeaning and humiliating, it can turn into destructive for sure. But it isn't necessarily destructive. And then there's the destructive marriage. And a destructive marriage is a completely different category. And you need to know what to look for. And so let me share with you some things that we can look for. Because the truth is that the Bible tells us that we all stumble in many ways in James 3:2, right? And so what often happens is that we see two sinners who are mutually sinning. And we think, you're both destructive. You're both handling things wrong. And you might be right, and you might also be wrong. Of course, you always have two sinners in a marriage. There is no marriage where you've got one sinner and one perfect person. So you always have two sinners. But just like David and Bathsheba, Bathsheba was a sinner, but she wasn't guilty of that sin. But let's say that in the midst of David trying to rape Bathsheba, we don't know what happened. Let's say that she resisted. Let's say that she pushed back. Let's say that she hit him or scratched him. And then they came into counseling, and he's saying, you know, my wife scratched me. My wife hit me. You know, I was just trying to give her a hug. And we're like, see, she's just as guilty as he is. Because we don't know what to look for. We don't know what questions to ask. And so we lump them in these categories without looking further to see what's going wrong. All of us are capable of sinful behavior. All of us are guilty of doing things that we deeply regret. You know, my mom was abusive, and when I became a mom, I could see some of my mom's whatever in me. When my little boy was 2 years old, we were in a dressing room, and I was trying on clothes, a terribly boring thing for a little two-year-old boy. He did not want to be there, and so he let me know in the most sinful way, like laying on the floor, throwing a fit, loud, so everybody else in the other dressing rooms could hear. And so I was embarrassed, and so in a moment of frustration, anger, I grabbed him, and I pulled him up by his arm, and I said, "Stop it!" And he says, really loud, "Mom, you broke my arm!" And his little elbow was dangling from his arm. And so everybody in the store heard it. I grabbed him, took him in the car seat, drug him to the emergency room. I said to the doctor, "I broke his arm." I didn't lie about it. I said, you know, thankfully they didn't have child abuse laws in those days. And I didn't break his arm. All I did was I dislocated his elbow, and it turned out he had a weak spot in his elbow, which was called nursemaid's elbow. So I didn't pull him that hard, but I thought I broke his arm. And I didn't lie about it. I didn't blame him. I didn't say it was his fault. I told my husband what I did. I did whatever I needed to do, not repeat that again. Are we capable of abusive incidents? Yes. Who hasn't done or said something that they deeply regret? But an abusive incident is very different than an abusive pattern. Right? And so We're going to look, if someone confesses to an abusive incident or someone describes an abusive incident, we want to know, is this a one-time thing or is this more than once? Because if you do something that hurts somebody, that's destructive, isn't it? When you do something that hurts someone that you love, that is destructive. And then, if you're a healthy person in a healthy relationship, you will take responsibility for that. You will own that. Oh my gosh, I'm so sorry. I didn't mean to say that. I didn't mean to do that. Or even if I meant to say that and do that, what is going on with me that I did that? I need to take care of what's going on in me so I don't do that again. Are we on the same page here? Isn't that what God tells us to do? When that's not happening in a marriage, it is becoming or is destructive. Because a painful marriage is true for everybody because you're married to sinners. A harmful marriage is one in which pain is inflicted intentionally, and there is no stopping it. There is no changing it. There is no remorse for it. There is no responsibility taken for it. In fact, oftentimes the other person, the victim, is blamed. It's your fault I acted that way. So when is the line crossed? When the harm is intentional, repetitive, non-repentive, and damaging. All right? That's one of the ways we know that the line is crossed. So we're going to start with a case study. Fred and Marie came to counseling, and they're describing their fifth anniversary. Did not go well. Does this happen? Here they come and they tell you about a specific incident. Did not go well. Fred and Marie, Fred mostly, planned this anniversary party, which he wanted to invite their friends, and they were celebrating their 5 years of love. They have no children. Fred is a mid-level executive. He's a very alpha male, loves to run, exercise. He's very gregarious, very outgoing, knows what he likes. And Marie is much more introverted. She works as a computer programmer. They don't have any children yet. She's very demure. She likes to cook. And she has a couple of really close friends. One of her closest friends is Geraldine. So Fred hates Geraldine. And so Marie invited Geraldine to their party, and he didn't want her to come. And so this is part of their fight where it starts. And then later on, Fred felt Marie really disrespected him at the party because he made a toast to her and she didn't respond with a toast back. And she wanted to wear this dress and he didn't like that dress and so he didn't want her to wear that. And she wore what he wanted her to wear, but later on she changed and she wore back the dress that he didn't want. So he felt like she was intentionally disrespecting him and feeling very frustrated with that. So they had this big fight. So based on what you know so far, where would you start with Fred and Marie? Any ideas? This is often what happens, right? This is your first session. Fred and Marie are sitting right here. Where do you go? What questions do you ask? You need more information, like what? Okay, how often does this happen? It wasn't bad, but lately it's been getting bad. And even Fred says, Marie's getting really depressed. I don't know what's going on with her, but she's just withdrawing more and more. Yeah.
The operative word I keep hearing here is the word respect coming from Fred. And I would really try to really go more emotionally focused with that and go, okay, so tell me about your feelings about respect and maybe really get to where he is.
So he says, I feel really hurt. And hurt because Marie, I know she loves me, but sometimes she just doesn't understand me. She doesn't respect me. She will treat me in ways that I don't like, and it hurts me. It frustrates me. Okay. Yeah. Okay. Any place else somebody would go? Yeah.
I'm hearing, like, trying to
Okay, so you're hearing some control. So maybe you wouldn't go so much with the respect, but you'd kind of go with more Marie. And, you know, how are you feeling with his desire to have you do things his way in order for him to feel respect, right? Okay, yeah. Mm-hmm. Okay.
I would like to see what kind of emotional baggage they brought into the marriage. They're not bringing what they expected from one another, what they see.
Okay. Okay, so now we're going to watch the anniversary party. So now you're going to see behind the scenes that we never see in counseling. So people express whatever they feel they can express about the incident. And now we're going to actually watch the day of the party and what happened. So when you understand that when people come to you in a counseling situation, they are just giving you a sliver of what's really going on. And so now we're going to watch the day of the party and what happened. It's a 10-minute video. The only thing is it's in French, so you do have to look at the subtitles. Fred and Marie, you know. But it's a great illustration of what I want to make a point of. So if you can't read English, you're out of luck. But it's English subtitles. If you know French, you're going to get more out of it. And it helps to listen to it because you hear the tone of voice. But we're going to watch the video now. So let's do that, and then we'll talk about it.
Ouais, j'ai complètement oublié. Bon, en passant.
Fred.
Bah quoi, t'as qu'à y aller, toi? C'est pas comme si t'avais des choses à faire. Oh, t'as son nom. C'est bien, tu t'es bougé pour ce soir. La bonne recette de maman. On mange juste un petit truc. En même temps, ils viennent pas pour manger là. Ah, ça c'est bon ce soir. Non, là, elle est occupée. Ok, ça va. Ça va. Ouais, elle te rappelle. Ok, bisous. Ciao. Marie, viens un peu, s'il te plaît. J'aurais dû me rappeler pour savoir ce qu'il doit apporter ce soir. C'est quoi cette histoire?
Finalement, j'ai invité Géraldine.
T'as invité Géraldine? Et tu sais bien, je peux pas la voir.
Oui, c'est ma copine.
Écoute, tu vas pas me faire ça ce soir. Hein? C'est quoi le plus important? C'est Géraldine, c'est ça? C'est Géraldine ou c'est nous?
Géraldine, c'est important pour moi.
Ouais, mais pas pour moi. Très bien. On a déjà invité Catherine, c'est déjà très bien.
Ok.
Gerlie ne vient pas.
Oh! On s'en fout de Géraldine! Hé, hey, vraiment! À quoi? Tu
veux que je mette la table? Non?
Je vais le faire.
Ok. Je vais prendre une douche. Tu l'appelles, hein?
Allô Géraldine, ça va? Ouais, ça va. Enfin, ouais, j'ai juste un problème pour ce soir en fait. Ouais, j'ai complètement foiré. Ouais, tu vas pas pouvoir venir. Non, c'est parce que j'ai pas cette place. Ouais, je me suis trompée. Non, pas du tout, c'est pas Fred. Non, bien sûr que non. Pourquoi tu dis ça? Non, c'est moi qui... Voilà. Ouais, je suis. Non, pas du tout. Non, t'inquiète. Ouais. Je dois te laisser là, d'accord? Ouais, salut.
Bah, tu vois, c'était pas si compliqué. Marie, c'est quoi ça? Espèce de robe, là.
La rouge?
Ben oui, la rouge.
C'est la robe pour ce soir?
C'est une blague. Tu vas quand même pas mettre ça.
Elle est très bien, cette robe.
Tu ressembles à rien, non? T'as vraiment aucun goût. Je vais t'en trouver, moi.
C'est quand même pas toi qui vas choisir ma robe pour ce soir.
Écoute, tu discutes pas. Tu vas me faire confiance, ok? Quoi? Il y a un problème? Moi, j'ai un problème. J'ai checké ton Facebook. T'es ami avec Alain, maintenant? C'est quoi, ce plan, avec Alain? Marie! C'est quoi, ce plan, avec Alain?
C'est Alain, c'est...
Ben oui, justement. C'est mon pote. Et mes potes, c'est mes potes, tu comprends ça? Mais pour qui tu te prends, hein? Pour qui tu te prends? Tu fais rien de tes journées, tu te perds tout le temps. Hein? Et maintenant, tu fais la bête devant mes potes? C'est ça? Hein? Mais tu te prends où, toi? Désolé. En fait, je trouve ça plutôt sympa que tu sois pas ta gueule. Bon, tu joues? Je vois pas rien. Magnifique. Tu seras superbe avec ça. Je t'aime, Marie. Elle habite où? Non, on a débuté d'abord sur les tribunes, on est descendu.
Tu verras alors.
Salut, bonsoir,
ça va?
Ça va bien?
Super.
Salut.
Va?
Merci.
Ça va,
elle est
superbe.
Bonsoir. Bonsoir tout le monde.
Hey,
Fredo.
Hey, Alain, ça va?
Hey, j'ai trouvé ça devant la porte.
Bonsoir.
Salut. Alors, on va faire ton fait du bouquin.
Ouais, à mort.
Ça me fait autre chose, pas quoi. Tu te l'air le coup de ma vie.
Putain, mais t'arrêtes pas, ça me fait chier, ça. C'est tout le temps, gars, c'est tout le temps.
Et toi, Kat, toujours célibataire?
Et toi, toujours aussi lourd.
Allez! Christophe, passe-moi la table.
Christophe et Céline, tu vont nous annoncer quelque chose?
On va attendre le dessert.
Non, 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 t'as dit maintenant, maintenant.
Eh bien, voilà, on va se lancer. On va se marier.
Wow!
Ouais,
elles sont toutes bonnes merdes.
J'ai un scoop. J'ai croisé Géraldine avec son dos fomètre. Catastrophe.
C'est vrai, ça beaucoup
les. Oh, c'est pas une grande perte. De toute façon, les absentes ont toujours tort.
Elle est commandée. Elle pouvait pas venir.
Bon, allez, on y va.
Oui.
Mange.
Ces deux œufs qui sont dans une poêle, elle retourne à un qui dit à l'autre, oh là là, il fait chaud. Et puis t'as l'autre qui fait,
ah, un œuf qui parle. Un discours.
Alors, cher Rodi, je suis très content de voir tous ici ce soir pour fêter nos 5 ans. Marie. Ma petite Marie. Je me souviens de toi, la première fois que je t'ai vue. Dans cette soirée où je connaissais personne. Tu étais magnifique. Enfin, quand je dis tu étais magnifique, ça veut dire que tu es devenu un gros boulet dégueulasse. Oh, ça va, ça va. Et donc, je suis tombé amoureux de toi. Comme ça. Premier jour. Et je t'aime toujours. Tu illuminais la soirée comme une rose illumine un bouquet de violettes royales.
Oh, c'est sensible.
Je me rappelle pas du tout de la soirée. C'était où? Marie, c'est tout.
Ça va, Fred, ça va. Oui. T'es chez Géraldine, mais t'es tout ça.
C'est chaud à 5 ans, hein? C'est ton empire!
Allô Marie, on t'entend plus, hein? Ouh, le réseau est interrompu, le réseau t'en remonte plus Marie. Un peu là. Allez, 5 ans d'amour.
À la bonne.
Non, je t'assure. J'ai parfois des trous.
Mais qu'est-ce que t'as merde? Il est roule, quel foutu ce mec.
Il est comme ça, les seuls qu'on y fasse.
Il faut lui rentrer dedans qu'il arrête. Ça va mal finir. Non, mais t'es con, toi. Je vais voir. C'est pas le moment. Non, mais là, c'est jamais le moment. J'en ai marre, moi, Marie. T'es à bout, là. Secoue-toi. T'as changé, hein. Je te reconnais plus, moi, Marie.
Tout le monde gueule tout le temps. On pourrait pas me laisser tranquille un petit peu?
Excuse-moi. Mais pourquoi tu lui dis jamais rien aussi? Tout le monde trouve que Fred est génial.
Souvent, il est
génial. Souvent. Et la robe, c'est lui qui l'a choisie.
Il m'a interdit d'inviter Géraldine.
De mieux en mieux.
Et vraiment, ça peut plus durer. Tu peux pas te laisser faire par ce bec, quoi. Allez, reprends-toi. C'est quoi la robe que toi, tu voulais mettre?
Alors, c'est ça. Alors, si je pars en vacances, c'est pour les meufs, c'est tout.
Non, bah attends, on part pour être tous ensemble en vacances, Alain, pas pour se taper les mains. C'est
spécial. Mais quoi? Qu'est-ce qu'il y a? Marie, je voulais lui dire un petit truc. Vas-y, Marie.
Bah quoi? Vas-y.
T'as quelque chose à dire?
Mais si.
Bon, je sais pas, tu parlais quoi? Vacances?
Des vacances.
Des meufs, vacances. Alors, quoi? Ouais, pas en vacances, c'est ça?
Vas-y.
Vas-y, c'est ça. Alors,
au Brésil, en Pologne,
was there a different picture there? He didn't hit her. Was there abuse? How would she describe that? How would she put it into words how he treated her? How do you say he criticized my dinner? He turned off the radio when he came into the house. He wouldn't let me wear the dress I wore. He didn't like my friend. I mean, it sounds like she's complaining. It sounds like she's being a nitpicker, doesn't it? It's very difficult for a woman to come in and talk about this in a way that a counselor or pastor is going to get. But if your daughter was Marie, what would you be feeling? Would you want her to live like this day in and day out and day in and day out? And you can see how charming Fred can be and how controlling. So when we would talk about Fred's feelings, that would just feed into his narcissism, right? If we just talk about his feeling of respect and his feeling of hurt, that would just expand him bigger and bigger, right? So we have to be careful about that. Emotional focus therapy doesn't work real well with these kind of couples. So we've got to be careful to discern what we're dealing with, right? Because otherwise we can feed it and she can feel less and less like you're not going to get her, right? So explain the Cassandra system. I've only heard it in terms of one other situation, so tell me what you hear it as. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so I heard that with gaslighting. And so it's not that Marie wouldn't be believed right now. Her friends believed her. Catherine believed her. She came in and said that. But I think it would be difficult for a woman to present what's going on in a way that counselors would get. There's emotional abuse. Right? If she says he's emotionally abusing me, we get what that means, but when you say, well, tell me what you mean, well, he criticized my dinner, it's like, all right, grow up. That happens sometimes. You know, we would start to demean that explanation because we can't see. It's like 1,000 bee stings. You know, one bee sting you can handle. 1,000 bee stings, you're going to get sick, really sick. And we could see her getting sicker and sicker, pulling into herself. And so many women who present as depressed really are in destructive marriages. And so it's very important for us to look at that. So let's look at what are some of the types of destructive marriages. 5 types we're going to talk about. And the first one, I'm just going to go over them pretty quickly. Reactive abuse. This is what we typically think is mutual abuse, or, you know, the biting and devouring each other, or maybe even only one person does it. They can't, you know, they don't know how to handle their temper. They don't know how to handle emotions. They're low EQ. They may have some bipolar. They're, you know, just all over the place. They can't handle frustration, low frustration tolerance. And understand in a reactive abuse, so they're reacting to a situation. Right? In reactive abuse, you can be very dangerous. Road rage, somebody can kill somebody. Right? So you can be reactive and pull out a gun and shoot somebody. So we're not minimizing that kind of abuse, but that's not the kind of abuse typically you're going to hear about. But you're going to category, you're going to make that into a category that you're going to think it's reactive abuse, and I'll tell you why in a minute. Right? But this is reactive abuse. But there's an element, this was controlling abuse. He was trying to control her. All right? In reactive abuse, when you ask them questions, you won't find the control element. All right? It's just low frustration tolerance, poor social skills, poor ability to handle frustration. Can be just as dangerous, but it's a different treatment plan. All right? When you have controlling abuse, which is our next category, it's a gross imbalance of power and control. And we began to see that in Fred and Marie, where Fred had the power and control and Marie had to do what he said. Now, this can get dicey in Christian churches because we believe in headship, right? And so the question we have to ask ourselves as believers, especially if you ascribe to the more complementarian view of Scripture, which is fine if you look at it from Jesus' perspective, but if you look at it from a distorted perspective, does a godly wife, if she's truly trying to be a godly woman in a complementarian church, does she ever have the right to say, no, I don't want to, I don't like that? Or is it because he's the head, does that rob her of her freedom to be an adult, to make her own decisions, to decide what to wear, when to visit her parents, how often to talk on the phone, if she's going to work and be a mom at the same time? Or does her husband make all those choices for her? And I'm going to argue that that's not the definition of headship biblically, because Jesus defined headship as very clearly to his disciples. He said, if you want to be the head of my church, this is what it looks like. You wash one another's feet. You serve. So the biblical definition of headship isn't you get to make all the decisions, you get your way, you get to order people around. In fact, Jesus warned his disciples, the Gentiles lead other people that way, not so with you. So the biblical definition of headship is you get to serve first. That's the definition of headship. However, you will have churches, as well as men, who define headship as, I get to manage her life. I get to decide for her. And if she resists that, she's being ungodly. She's being unsubmissive. That's where this respect comes in a lot, because as much as I love Emerus Egret's book in a proper context, in this context, it's very skewed. Right, and it becomes a breeding ground for endorsement of, I get to decide because she should respect me. And so that word respect is helpful to unpack some in a counseling setting, but it often means she will do what I say. And if she doesn't do what I say, I feel disrespected. And so does that mean he gets to control her life? And I don't think God gives the stewardship of someone's life to another adult. When you're an adult, you're required to steward your life. And when you partner with someone in marriage, you're not giving him the reins to steward your life, right? And we would never, when a woman would be controlling her husband or trying to control her husband that way, and she were to go to counseling, a pastor would never say, well, the Bible calls for mutual submission, so just submit to her. We would say, you need to speak up and be a person here, in a good way, but you need to be a person. So oftentimes what you're having here, when you see mutual abuse, is a woman resisting this control. Let me give you an example. So a couple came to me for counseling. The incident was that Bill in a fit of anger, took her cell phone and threw it in the sink. Now, Bill is sitting before you as the pastor, counselor, confessing this. He's owning it. So it looks good. He's saying, I shouldn't have done it. I was wrong. It was reactive abuse. Right? Because she wouldn't submit. Okay, so what's the story? Well, you know, I had this rule at the house that Teresa, when I'm home, I want Teresa to be available to me. You know, she talks on the phone a lot to her family, and I don't like it, but if I'm not home, I don't care. She can talk on the phone when she wants. But when I'm home, I don't want her on the phone. That's our time together, and I just want us to have our time. Now, if Teresa and Bill as a couple mutually made that rule, that would be fine. But that's not how it went down. Bill made this rule over Teresa that she was not to talk on the phone when he was home. So during dinner, she gets this phone call, and her family knows not to call at night because they already know Bill's rules. Teresa tries to submit to Bill. So she thinks, oh my gosh, there must be an emergency because nobody calls me at night because they know Bill's rule. So she decides to answer the phone. She looks to Bill and she says, I'm going to take this. It must be an emergency. He glares at her. She picks up the phone. It's her sister. She had an emergency with a work issue. Teresa was a computer programmer. She walked her through it. It took 15 minutes. And when she hung up, Bill said, give me your phone. Teresa said, no, I'm not going to give you my phone. He goes, give me your phone. So they wrestled the phone. That's where the phone ended up in the sink. Okay. So as a counselor, if you're not asking these questions, and even if you found those answers, does Bill have the right to tell Teresa when she can talk on the phone to her family as an adult woman? Is that called headship? Now, I don't think so. But you will see incident and incident, small incidents, big incidents. So does Fred have the right to tell Marie Geraldine can't come to the party? Fred has the right to say, I don't like Geraldine. I'd rather she not come. She and I don't hit the, you know. And Marie has the right to say, but she's my great friend and you invited Alan. I don't like him either. Right? We each have friends that we don't like, but they're our friends and we're coming to our party together. Or does Fred have the right to tell Marie what she can wear and what she can see and who she can talk to and who she can't? He was even telling her how she could feel, right? When she started to get upset, oh, Marie, don't feel that way, right? She couldn't even feel her feelings without him telling her she couldn't feel those. How many of you are feeling a little uncomfortable, like, oh, my gosh, there's a lot of this going on. A lot of this going on. And it leads to emotionally destructive marriages. Let me talk about ways. I've got three PowerPoints to advance, so hold on. All right, quickly, let me just talk about this escalation, because when someone tries to exert control over one, let's say isolation via guilt, you know, a husband is trying to isolate his wife, no, you can't hang out with that person because that hurts my feelings. Or I don't want you to talk to your mother as much because it makes me feel like you're not leaving and cleaning, right? So he's isolating through guilt. Like, ooh, I'm being a bad wife. And she resists by hiding the conversation or ignoring him or complaining to others, right? We might see her as being sinful. And we might be right, but her resistance isn't wrong. We have to teach her how to resist in the right way, right? Then he becomes more aggressive. We saw that with Fred, right? And she might verbally attack back or sneak or do other things. He might directly control and threaten, if you don't do this, this will happen to you. And she counter threats, or she resists, leaves, tries to get away. Like, we've seen lots of incidents where a man's blocking the door, he won't let her out, she pushes him or scratches him, and then he calls the police and she gets arrested for domestic violence, right? And it's not mutual abuse here. It's not reactive abuse. She's resisting being controlled. And she might be resisting in the wrong way, but don't see it as mutual. See it as a resistance to control. We can teach her how to do it in more appropriate ways, but she needs to resist. Direct abuse, intimidation, restraint, and physical attacks, swearing, calling police, etc. So we see this escalation, and this is where oftentimes we get confused as pastors and counselors. They're both abusive. They're both wrong. They're both sinful. And they are, but the power dynamic is very different. And if we're not attuned to that, we're going to say, you're both sinful, you're both wrong, you both need to work on things. He's not any more abusive than you are. And we've missed the whole imbalance of power and control over. Does that make sense? Now we can have power. This is a quote by Jason Meyer, who's the new pastor of John Piper's church. So it's not John Piper's church anymore, it's Jason Meyer's church. But he says, hyperheadship, this whole over, power over. And Piper's church is a pretty complementarian, headship-oriented church. Okay, it really is. But this is what Jason's saying now. Hyperheadship is a satanic distortion of male leadership. But it can fly under the radar of discernment because it's disguised as strong male leadership. Make no mistake, it's harsh, oppressive, and controlling. In other words, hyperheadship becomes a breeding ground for domestic abuse. So, someone controls someone physically, right? They can bully them, they can hurt them. You get pretty scared and you do what someone wants if they've got a gun to your head or they've got a gun to the, you know, in their pocket or if they're putting their fist through the wall. And so people can use physical abuse, but they can also use emotional abuse. And people have told me, Christians have said, there is no such thing as emotional abuse in the Bible. And that's not true. I don't know where they're getting that. The Bible is full of things that talk about emotional abuse. For example, with their words, the godless what? Destroy someone. Words. Sticks and stones will break my bones, but words will never. That's not in the Bible. All right? The Bible's very clear. Reckless words pierce like a sword. Colossians 3, do not let any abusive speech come out of your mouth. The Bible talks about abusive speech. It talks about reckless words. It talks about our tongue. Nehemiah is full of the mocking and contempt of the people in the situation. And life and death is in the power of the tongue. And Jesus says that when you call someone a fool, it's like you've murdered them with your tongue. The Bible is very clear that our words can do a lot of damage. Here's a verse in James. I love this verse. He says, no one can tame the tongue. It's restless and evil, full of deadly poison. Sometimes it praises our Lord and Father, and sometimes it curses those who've been made in the image of God. And so blessing and cursing come pouring out of the same mouth. And what does he say? Surely, my brothers and sisters, this is not what? Right. Emotional abuse is not right. It's not biblical. And so what does emotional abuse look like? Raging, constant criticism, ridicule, and demeaning, belittling. I remember working with a pastor. How many of you are pastors again? Okay, I want you to put yourself in this pastor's shoe. He came to me for counseling, and he said, I don't know what to do. He goes, every Sunday when I get up to preach, I'm feeling more and more insecure. I've got this guy in my church, and after every service, he gives me a list of everything I did wrong. Every passage I didn't quote right, every proof text I didn't investigate properly, every theological tittle of whatever I didn't say right, you know, the illustrations that were wrong. And he just says, Pastor, you're just not missing, you're missing the mark every week. You know, pretty soon I'm going to have to go to the elders about you because I just think you're missing it here. I don't think you're really pertinent to, you know, meet our needs. And he says, every week I'm worrying about this one man, what he's going to say about me and how he's going to critique me that week. And I'm finding myself making my sermon so he'll like them. And it's driving me crazy because I can't be myself anymore. One man, once a week, and how's it affected him? Words affect us. People affect us. Imagine if you had to live with that all the time. Withholding, restricting, like Fred did, isolating, threatening, abandoning. They may not seem as obvious, but they also are abusive. I had a man who didn't speak to his wife for over 6 months. That's emotionally abusive. It's emotionally abusive. Coercing, accusing, ordering, ignoring, minimizing. When we listen to the fights that they had, we need to listen for this element of power and control. Fred minimized a lot of her feelings, right? The fact that she protested, I want to invite Gerald, she's not important. She's not important to me. Ordering, accusing her of having a friendship with his friend, and then saying, actually, I kind of like it. It's kind of crazy making, isn't it? On the one hand, screaming at you, at the next hand, touching your face like you love you. I mean, it's very confusing inside. Like, who is this man? What does he really think? What does he really feel? subtle and abusive behaviors that are more nonverbal. I remember in a counseling session, a man was opening up his heart, and he was on the verbally abusive side, but his wife was in her own way abusive. And so he was opening up his heart and sharing something, and she went like this. As soon as he opens up his heart, she goes, "Aw," like the little violin, you know? So what would you do as a counselor when someone did that? See, it's so hard for us to be honest. We don't want to lose her. We don't want to make her mad. Well, what I said to her is, you know, you're coming to me for a reason. I want to give you some feedback on what I just saw. Are you willing to listen? What? Well, you're telling me you want a good marriage and you're paying big bucks to come here every week. So let me tell you that what you just did here was emotionally abusive. It was humiliating and degrading to your husband. And he won't ever open up to you if you keep doing that. We need to speak the truth about what's happening before our eyes. I cannot tell you the number of clients who say, "My counselor said nothing." And we're afraid because we're afraid that they're going to walk out. It would be better for them to walk out than for them to believe that what they did was no big deal, which is what they're going to believe if you say nothing. We'll talk about that some more later. Like a thousand bee stings. The psalmist says, "Your tongue cuts like a sharp razor. You're an expert at telling lies. You love evil more than good and lies more than truth. You love to destroy others with your words." That's called emotional abuse. "Please listen and answer me, for I'm overwhelmed by my troubles. My heart pounds in my chest. The terror of death assaults me. Fear and trembling overwhelm me." It's affecting his body. He's having an anxiety attack. "I can't stop shaking. It's not an enemy who taunts me. I could bear that. It's not my foes who arrogantly insult me. I could have hidden from them. Instead, it is you, my equal, my companion, my close friend." Does the Bible not speak about emotional abuse? It certainly does. It talks about the effects of emotional abuse. Proverbs tells us it's better to live alone in the corner of an addict than to live in a house with a contentious, angry person, woman, but man too. It takes its toll. It takes its toll. "Their insults have broken my heart, and I am in despair." Emotional abuse is real, and it crushes the spirit. And I think it's really important as church leaders and counselors that we not minimize its effects, because the Bible does not. The Bible does not. So if a woman came to you and she said, "My husband stabbed me last night," I hope none of you would say, "You know what? That must mean you're called to suffer for Jesus." I had a woman she didn't get stabbed, but her husband beat her, and he said that to her. You're called to suffer. I hope none of you would say that. But oftentimes when a woman comes and says, "My husband's emotionally abusing," we sort of say that. Bear your cross. Let it roll off your back. The Bible says it doesn't roll off your back. It says that reckless words pierce like a sword. They do their damage. And it's important that we not invalidate the effects of emotional abuse, because God doesn't. God doesn't invalidate those effects. Emotional abuse systematically degrades, diminishes, and eventually can destroy the personhood of the other. And we saw that in Marie. In 10 minutes, you saw the effects on Marie of just these words. And you could see Marie shrinking. Could you see it? Okay. I'm not going to talk a lot about this right now, but there is sexual abuse in marriage. I was teaching at Westminster Seminary on this, and a seminarian raised his hand when I was talking about this, and he said, "I don't understand what you're talking about. There can't be any sexual abuse in marriage." And I said, "What do you mean?" He goes, "Well, a wife's not allowed to say no." And this was an MDiv student who had no shame saying this in front of everybody else, because that was his mindset. I'm entitled. The Bible tells me I'm entitled, because it says in 1 Corinthians 7, you're not allowed to say no. What's really interesting about that passage, What's really interesting about that passage, if you think about the context, the Apostle Paul emphasizes something other than "you're not allowed to say no" in that passage. The thing that was so radical in that passage for the Jews of the day was that was a very patriarchal culture. It wasn't a complementarian. It was a patriarchal culture where wives didn't have much say, right? And so every wife in Jewish culture knew her conjugal duties. So Paul was not writing to her. And he wasn't writing to the husband saying, see, you get to get, your wife doesn't get to say yes. No. The operative word in that passage was likewise. Likewise. Husbands, you have as much responsibility and obligation to your wife. There isn't this power over, because your wife has as much power over you as you think you have over her. It's mutual. That was so radical for that time. Paul's leveling out a culture and saying, hey, wives, you're not just under with no choice and no voice. This is a mutual relationship, and it operates with mutuality, likewise. And so when we support, inadvertently, this power over structure under the guise of biblical headship, we're not reading our Bible correctly and inadvertently hurting families and hurting them from healing because we're using the headship as power over instead of servant first. When I did a blog on sexual abuse in marriage, I'm not shocked by much anymore, but I was shocked by the number of Christian women who wrote in, both privately and on the blog, about their sexual abuse in marriage. Their husbands forcing them to do things that left injuries, unbelievable, anal, horrible raping of women. And even when some of them had gone to their pastors still didn't stick up for them, didn't confront the husband, didn't deal with it. And then that woman doesn't feel like she can even go to that church anymore because now he knows everything that's going on and I'm not important enough to protect. I feel degraded. I feel humiliated. I feel violated because he asked what happened and I told him and it didn't matter. Can you imagine? It's awful. It's awful. And here's an area that we don't think about too much, and that's economic abuse. Economic abuse. You know, you can have a lot of power over someone if you hold the purse strings, right? If you don't give them any money, if they have no power in the money-making decisions, if you withhold money and you hide money, you mismanage money, you micromanage money, you don't give her access as a joint partner to the checking account. She doesn't even know what you make. She doesn't even have an ATM card to use or a credit card to use. Treating her like a child or a slave instead of an adult partner has a lot of power over someone. I worked with a woman who was a master's degree nurse, and she was married to a doctor. And she had four or five children. They were homeschooling them. And he would go off on these mission trips, wonderful, doing these great doctor mission trips, would leave her with a set amount of cash, like $200, that she could manage for 2 weeks. No credit card, no access to any money. He's out of the country. If something were to happen where she needed money, she didn't know what she was going to do. It didn't matter what she said, how she appealed to him. He's in control of the money. She had no idea how much he made, where their accounts were. She had no access to them. That's power over someone in an inappropriate way. And even if that's all you hear in listening to what's going on, that's a destructive marriage. It's a destructive marriage. And last but not least, spiritual abuse. You know, it's very easy for people to get what they want by twisting the scriptures, right? And when you call someone a Jezebel spirit, or you tell them that they're influenced by Satan, or that if they're not going to do what you say because you've got the hotline to God, it's spiritual abuse, whether it's done by a church, or whether it's done by a cult, or whether it's done by a husband or a wife. Either way, when we do that to someone, we can be spiritually abusive. And we're doing that to try to control them. So this is a wheel. You can get it on the internet. It's an educational group for men who batter, the Duluth model. And it just talks about the different ways of power and control. So using coercion and threats, using intimidation, emotional abuse, isolation, minimizing, denying, blaming, using children, using male privilege, using economic abuse. So this is just a kind of a encapsulated wheel that shows all the different ways that you can have power over someone.